Welcome to the final episode in this season of Irish Imperial Lives. I'm A.B. Philpin Bowman.
And I'm Kate O'Malley. And in this episode, we are going to India. And we've had lots of requests for lives based in India. And there's so many to choose from. But we've actually picked today a very unusual person who's not very well known, I don't think. His name is Charles Teggart. He is essentially an imperial policeman on the face of it, but he's actually also an intelligence agent.
You do get the impression in this story that this might have been the original inspiration for James Bond. Bombs are thrown, paperweights explode.
There's a Staffordshire Bull Terrier on a car bonnet,
AB. He keeps a bomb as a paperweight, and then one day it's a diffused bomb, and one day he lugs it across the room. The whole thing blows up, right? Because it wasn't diffused, it turns out. An awful lot of intelligence work. It's not like the movies. It's kind of boring. It's kind of paperworky. No. This guy actually is right out of James Bond.
He sets it alight in more ways than one.
Very well put. Yes, he does. He sets it alight, throws it across the room and makes it explode. And it doesn't just go to Bengal, though. He also comes back to Ireland to work as an intelligence officer during the War of Independence. He narrowly misses that infamous incident where Michael Collins famously wipes out most of British intelligence based in Ireland. He also ends up in British Mandate Palestine, of all places, where to this day there's a fortification named after him. So a remarkable life on the global stage of the empire at a moment when the empire itself is fading, when Ireland, when India and other places are asserting themselves, starting to break free, and his loyalty to empire, which possibly made sense in his early life, gradually starts to come into conflict with his own identity as an Irishman, because Ireland is changing, because India is changing, because the 1916 Rising, the Amritsar massacre, all of these things are changing the context, and he is left by the end of his life as something of a relic from a bygone
exactly,
era.
Yes, exactly. And joining us today, we have the wonderful Dr. Michael Silvestri of Clemson University. He's the author of Ireland and India, Nationalism, Empire and Memory. And we started off by asking Michael to tell us a little bit about Charles Teggart's early life.
He comes from a Protestant family. His father is actually a Church of Ireland minister. And his parents die when he's in his teens, and Teggart and his brother are in the custody of their uncle for part of their teenage years. He's well-educated. He attends a preparatory school in Rathmines and then the Portora Royal School in Enniskillen, where he excelled at both academics and also at sports. Rugby, for example, you can still find photos of him and his rugby gear on the walls of the school. And then he attended Trinity College Dublin for a year, did very well, got honors in mathematics, but he decided that he wanted to pursue a living as soon as possible. At times, he referred to himself as impatient and impulsive, and he decided that he didn't want to finish his degree, wait to enter a profession. He saw these advertisements for the Indian police, which an entry into the Indian police was by competitive examination. So he had no relatives in India. He really didn't know what you did in the Indian police, but he saw that it involved horsemanship. So he thought, oh, this is going to be fun. This is going to be like adventures, like out of boys' adventure stories that were so popular. Empire offered opportunities, you know, especially in Dublin, especially among the Anglo-Irish. And so he took the exam and did well enough to enter the Indian police.
I had this just sneaking kind of desire for him to be a dropout after a year in Trinity, because I knew he only spent a year there. But what you're saying is speaks much more to the personality that we're going to find out much more about. So when and how does he transfer to India? Where does he arrive?
Bengal. You had to put down a province on the application, which I think he put down more or less randomly. And he was actually posted in what's today the province of Bihar in India, which was then a part of this very large province of Bengal. And he did well in the police training school, had a Scottish mentor who singled him out for a special assignment, and he took charge of the city police of Patna. So a lot of responsibility for a young colonial officer. So the first years of his time in the police were these very mundane bureaucratic duties that colonial servants had to do. He was involved with these plague measures. He had to deal with parking arrangements when there was a viceregal event, though that changed when he came to Calcutta in 1906 and was appointed to the Calcutta police.
Just to, for our listeners, give them a sense of Bengal, because really, in many ways, it's the engine room of the Indian economy for centuries. But since the 1750s, it's also the key theatre of British plunder in India. That's the place they've been making their money and indeed using to finance the plunder of much of the rest of India. And there's a particularly contentious partition in Bengal in 1905. So talk to us about that and how Bengal itself becomes like a hotspot of resistance.
Yes, the partition is a very important event. It's carried out by Lord Curzon, the Viceroy of India, ostensibly for the purposes of administrative efficiency, because Bengal was a very large and unwieldy province, and it was to be divided. In reality, the goal was to blunt the force of Indian nationalism, because Bengal was a center of nationalism. It's a place where Indians, Bengalis, had had an encounter with the British, with the colonial rulers for a long time. Many of the leaders of Indian nationalism at the time were Bengali, though they came from all parts of India. So this is really trying to blunt the force of that movement. And what it does is it sparks a new nationalist campaign, which is known as the Swadeshi movement, the own country movement, which is essentially foreshadowing some of the things that Mohandas Gandhi is going to do in his later campaigns, boycotting British goods, bonfires of British textile, and sometimes some coercive measures, some pressure applied to people not to buy British products, but to buy Indian ones. Mm-hmm. So these are nonviolent protests, but some more radical Bengalis begin to carry out assassinations, both of British officials and of Indians who serve the colonial state.
In Bengal in particular, the manifestation of nationalism there is not of the Gandhian nonviolent form.
Absolutely. And what you might think is a more mainstream of Gandhian nationalism is certainly present and a powerful force in Bengal. But there is also this strong tradition of violent resistance, which goes back to the partition of Bengal. And these movements, as they do elsewhere in India, too, they tend to intersect. You can be a supporter of the Congress and also regard the revolutionaries as heroes. You know, at different times in Bengal and in other parts of India, some of the revolutionaries, particularly those who are executed for what they have done, they're regarded as some of the greatest heroes of Indian nationalism, of the freedom struggle, as it comes to be known, rivaling even Gandhi. Mm. A good example is in 1912. The partition of Bengal is reversed, but the capital is moved from Calcutta to Delhi. And when the then viceroy, Lord Harding, is making a ceremonial entrance to Delhi on an elephant, because that's what one did. If you're viceroy in 1912, Bengali revolutionaries throw a bomb that wounds him.
Can I just come back to Teegart? Because his wife, Kathleen Teggart's memoir, gives us a real sense, albeit somewhat biased, I'm sure, of his adventures and his physique.
Yes. I mean, the word that comes to mind when you're talking about Charles Teggart is flamboyant. And a lot of police work was mundane. Mm. The colonial records of the intelligence services of the police can be numbing in terms of their volume. You know, tens of thousands of pages and reports, both on individual revolutionaries and these wider analytic reports that sometimes span decades, talking about the development of terrorism in India. But Teggart really gravitated to the cloak and dagger aspects of intelligence work. He was someone who might have been the person who fired a shot who killed a prominent revolutionary in 1915, Jyotin Mukherjee. Mm. Teggart was a great target of the revolutionaries. He's targeted for assassination. Other British officials are being targeted for assassination, too. And he made a point of driving around Calcutta in an open car with his Staffordshire Bull Terrier perched on the hood behind him. One former Indian civil service officer said he was imperturbable in the face of danger, you know, that going through the streets of Calcutta in his open car with his faithful dog kept up morale, and they felt somewhere or another he could not fail. Oh. You know, he's a subject of a number of assassination attempts, and so he has this era of invulnerability about him, like someone who's in a war and has this is never going to get even a scratch.
Are there any in particular that spring to mind as an interesting story to share with our listeners?
Sure, there are several. In 1924, a European businessman, an Englishman named Day, is looking in shop windows in Calcutta. The assassin thinks that he is Teggart. He sort of looked like Teggart and shoots him dead. And then in 1930, the revolutionaries are really beginning to widen their scope. At the time of Gandhi's civil disobedience campaign that starts with the Salt March to the Sea in 1930 that's so vividly brought to life in the film Gandhi. Three revolutionaries make a raid on what was known as the Writers' Building in Dalhousie Square in central Calcutta. Tegar is one of their targets. They do not get him, but they kill an officer who is the inspector general of prisons. So he's involved in this sort of, you know, gun battle in the heart of British administration as well. This is not an attack by revolutionaries, but he almost blew himself up because he kept a small bomb that was thought to be a dud as a paperweight on his desk, and then decides to chuck it across the room at a map, trying to target what was a particularly unpleasant posting for the police. It exploded. It was not, in fact, a dud. Officers came running in believing there had been another attack by the revolutionaries, but in this case, it was Tegar himself.
Wow, he really leaves chaos in his wake, doesn't he?
There is an incident in 1930 when a bomb is thrown into this open car that he was so brazenly riding around Calcutta in, wounding others, but he was not hurt. In fact, jumped out of the car on foot and pursued the assailants.
Of course.
Actually shooting and killing one. I mean, you can see why he was targeted. You know, he's probably shot Jyotin Mukherjee in 1915, you know, one of the most prominent of the Bengali revolutionaries, shot and wounded others. And, you know, this is not something that's discussed in his wife Kathleen's memoir, but he was accused of carrying out brutal interrogations. In fact, he was actually formally accused, along with other police officers, of carrying out torture of revolutionary suspects in 1918 by Annie Besant, half Irish theosophist who is at this time very prominent figure in Indian nationalism during the First World War, the first female president of the Indian National Congress.
You've actually described one of his techniques in torturing. Apparently it was to aim a loaded gun, aim it just above a suspect's head, fire, then lower the gun at their head and ask a question.
Absolutely. And that's very interesting. That anecdote has survived because that is actually from the oral history of another policeman. And you very rarely get these admissions of that type of brutal interrogation technique. But that was certainly Tegar's reputation, in this case confirmed by one of his colleagues. So he's flamboyant. He loves this sort of cloak and dagger. He loves going in disguise. You know, he can't disguise himself as a Bengali, but at times he's disguised as a Sikh taxi driver. A lot of intelligence officers seem to work through Indian subordinates in terms of how they handled agents, people inside the revolutionary groups who were the primary source of information for the police. Tegart, I think, in particular, with his flair, loved to meet them personally and loved to meet them in lonely places late at night to get information.
One would expect, if he's got Irish skin, that in the heat of India, that's probably going to turn slightly reddish. So ideally, meeting at night is going to at least disguise the fact that he's...
That is a very good point.
Admittedly, in northern India, people can be fairly pale, but we are noted for our paleness at a global level. So one would think that he would probably have to meet at night just purely if he wants to be in disguise. Unless, I mean, I don't know, was he using beards, makeup? Do we know how he disguised himself?
Yeah, he used apparently a false beard, someone from the northwest frontier. Yes, exactly. Turban, and, you know, it's a good way to sort of hide, you know, as many of his features as possible.
Wow. I was going to say he must have been an extraordinary linguist because, you know, one thing to pass off as a Sikh, but you would also have to know the local language, the accent, the slang, the vernacular, all of that to really pass himself off convincingly.
Yeah, it's a little hard to tell exactly because, again, we just have his wife's testimony, but he did apparently learn languages quickly while he was still a young police officer. You know, he learned two Indian languages.
One of the really interesting things that you bring out is that much as he's hated by these revolutionaries, he's noted at the time as somebody who treats his Indian colleagues with great respect, considerably more than would have been the norm at the time, which strikes me both as quite enlightened for the time, but probably also very smart if you're in the good intelligence business and you want these guys to be bringing you back intel you can use.
Absolutely. And I think Tegar was not unique in this, that good relations with Indian subordinate officers was something that was vital to the functioning of the intelligence branch of the Bengal police. Because in most cases, these were the people who did interviews, who persuaded or coerced members of revolutionary groups to turn informer, to become agents, you know, the people who really did the difficult and dangerous spade work for all this intelligence that ends up in these long, voluminous reports and dossiers. He had a particularly close bond with one officer named Basanta Kumar Chatterjee, who was regarded as one of the best Indian officers at the time, and he was assassinated in 1916. There had been previous attempts on his life because these revolutionaries target Indian colonial servants as well as the British. So Tegart was, by all accounts, extremely distraught. One account from an Indian policeman said that he wept like an unsophisticated village woman. You know, I saw a file where someone, I think it was Tegart, had written, you know, in big capital letters, Basanta dead across the across the file. So obviously very affected.
Do we get a sense at this time of what role, if any, his Irishness had throughout this part of his career? You know, as the Sinn Féin movement was gathering apace. I'm thinking in particular of somebody like Lord Lytton, who was governor of Bengal, who said Tegart was an Irishman and for all we knew, he might be a Sinn Féiner at heart. So this idea that you don't know where his loyalties lie.
Yeah, I think that was Lord Lytton making a joke.
Of course.
I don't think you could meet Charles Tegart and not know that he was Irish. And I think there was this sincere attachment to Ireland. His wife wrote historical novels about Ireland, you know, this interest in Irish folklore and that's prominent among the Anglo-Irish at this time. I think with Tegart, there is this attachment to Ireland and his sense of himself as an Irishman, his sense of Irish identity, which is intertwined with his loyalty to the empire. I don't find any evidence that he ever wavered in his support of the British Empire or of Ireland's connection to Britain. About the closest thing I've seen is that he thought that the Black and Tans and the British paramilitary actions during the War of Independence were a dark spot on Anglo-Irish relations. He's sometimes talked about as someone who's, well, he was Irish, so thus that gave him insight into the mindset of these nationalist groups. And I think on a certain level, that's true. But if you look at the things that Tegart wrote about them, he gives this famous lecture in 1932 called Terrorism in India, which is really almost all about his experience in Bengal. It's full of these really appalling colonial stereotypes. Mm-hmm. That perverted is a word that comes up a lot, you know, that the revolutionaries are pitiful. They're being misled by their leaders. They're pitiful dupes. This movement comes out of perverted religion and perverted patriotism. You know, this is not the language of someone who's very sympathetic with nationalists.
And what you're getting at is that his Irishness was something that British Raj administrators foisted on him, really, that it was their perceptions of his Irishness that's been documented and his loyalty was steadfast.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, because we know that at the outset of the First World War, there were lots of Irish people who joined the British Army thinking that, as many Indians did too, that by doing so, they could show themselves to be loyal colonial subjects and in that way win greater independence for the home country. But obviously in the Irish context, everything changes after the 1916 Rising and the disastrous decision to execute the rebels, which turns them into martyrs, so that by the end of the war, there's a landslide victory for Éamon de Valera's Sinn Féin party. I'm just curious if Tegart's own politics evolved as the politics of Ireland did, or if he remained in that kind of pre-World War I imperial mindset.
I think that's a very good question, and I think it would be more the latter. He could be somewhat dispassionate about the developments in Irish nationalism and Irish separatism. One thing that's also, I think, a very interesting connection and important connection to Ireland is that in Bengal, at the same time Charles Tegart is performing all this important intelligence work, the Bengali revolutionaries, they're eclectic. They are inspired by many revolutionary and anti-colonial movements, as well as Indian history. But some of them do have a very special affinity for Ireland. So both the achievements of the Easter Rebels, the martyrdom of Patrick Pearse, and also what they see as Irish revolutionaries during the War of Independence offering a practical blueprint for armed resistance. One of the most popular books among the revolutionaries is Dan Breen's My Fight for Irish Freedom, which was published in 1924. It was banned, but it was also translated into multiple Indian languages, Hindi, Tamil, and Punjabi. And you have accounts by British officials saying, you know, this is a textbook for revolution. And it's interesting. In one case, the government of Bengal, which had already banned the book, asked Tegart's advice as police commissioner of Calcutta, is there anything else we can do? And he says, no, there's really not anything else, any other powers we need, and you're just going to bring more attention to it.
Yeah.
And he said, an interesting book founded on facts which are now history. And that's what he had to say.
Fascinating. About it. And that happened in the wake of the Chittagong armory raid. Is that right, Michael? Am I right in saying that?
Yes, which is the revolutionaries in 1930 calling themselves the Indian Republican Army in the town of Chittagong in eastern Bengal. They carry out, again, something that shocks British officials, and it's a big intelligence failure for the Bengal police. They carry out these coordinated raids, cutting telegraph lines, derailing a train, stealing all these weapons from an armory in the town of Chittagong. It's very fortunate for the British that they do not realize when they're planning this that the ammunition is stored separately. So they have machine gun, they have lots of rifles, but they have very little ammunition, which really hinders what they can do.
And they also coincided it with Easter in homage to the Irish Rising, not realizing that some of the British officials wouldn't be in their postings because it was a holiday for them, a religious holiday. And these are Hindu nationalists. It provides such an interesting counterpoint to Teagart's own life there that they are thousands of miles away being influenced by Irish nationalists at home here, but crucially by Dan Breen's version of 1916 at which he wasn't present. It's just fascinating. Yeah, absolutely.
Can I just come back to Teagart? Because one of the intriguing details is he is actually recalled to Ireland to work in intelligence in 1920. And of course, famously in November of that year is the Michael Collins strike on British intelligence services, where he in a single day takes out the so-called Cairo squad of British intelligence officers. Do we know if their paths crossed at all, or if Teagart was perhaps just off the radar because he'd only just got back?
The Prime Minister, David Lloyd George, had requested the loan of Indian officers. So Charles Teagart, who at the time was working for Indian political intelligence that coordinated intelligence about Indian revolutionaries and anti-colonialists across the globe, which Kate is very familiar with, Teagart was working for them in London. He and another officer, one of his colleagues from Bengal, a man named Godfrey Denham, was recalled, and they were to set up a new Secret Service Bureau. That the idea was you would recruit Irishmen in Britain, send them to Ireland to get intelligence, to kind of penetrate the revolutionaries, the Irish Republican Army and Sinn Féin, that were proving difficult for British officials to get intelligence about. Teagart is not in Ireland very long in 1920. It's not one of his more successful episodes in his imperial career. He thought that those in charge of Irish intelligence were amateurish. He didn't have a magic solution. As he put it, I don't have an open sesame. I don't have a magic way to kind of crack this problem. In fact, the word he used is like, this calls for plodding and patient investigation. He wants to kind of replicate what he's done in Bengal with all these files and these what were called history sheets of everyone.
And he's a day late and a dollar short. That can't
exactly. And so he's probably talking about several years in terms of time frame, and the British want results now.
He's moved to Palestine. It's almost as if partition is following him around. Tell us a little bit about his service in Palestine.
Sure. This is after Teagart has retired from the Indian police. And in 1937, in the midst of the Arab revolt in Palestine, he is offered the position of Inspector General of the Palestine police. He turns that down. He said, I don't know much about Palestine, about local conditions. But he undertakes this mission along with another Indian police officer named David Petrie, who's later head of MI5 during the Second World War, to report and reorganize the police during the Arab revolt. And there's a lot of things that Teagart recommends. Some of these come out of his experience in Bengal of building up the intelligence, of making sure there's secure housing for subordinate police, for Arab subordinate police in particular, who would be targeted for assassinations, making sure that they are well paid and that their families will be compensated if something happens to them. So there are these administrative measures, but also, Teagart and Petrie are very much take the attitude that this is insurgency. This is the gloves need to come off. He talks about we need the tough type of man, not necessarily literate, who knows as much of the game as the other side for the sort of rough work that needs to be done. So Teagart, I think in Palestine, his name is associated with torture, with third degree interrogation techniques, as well as the development of intelligence. And probably one thing that he's linked with the most, one of his most visible legacies, is this proposal that he comes up with for these series of 70 fortified police posts in the Palestinian Mandate along the the border with Syria and Lebanon to prevent essentially insurgents from escaping across the border. These fortified stations known as Taggart forts are simply Taggarts. Interestingly, when he returns to London in 1938 at a farewell dinner, there's this wonderful photo of it. They make this centerpiece at the table of these Taggart forts, which are with barbed wire and police towers, and I think that
tasteful.
Kind of sums up. Yeah, tasteful.
This is your legacy, a series of barbed wire installations in the Middle East.
Do any of them survive, like the way that our Martello towers are still here?
I think some of them are still in existence. You know, they were not tremendously effective. You know, insurgents found ways you could just cut the barbed wire and escape.
Towards the end of his life, he's struggling with the way Irish politics has evolved in the intervening years. And in particular, Ireland's neutrality really troubled him. And I believe he could be responsible for the U-boat scares that happened here during the Second World War. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Taggart continued to be involved in police work and intelligence to a certain degree during the Second World War. And he reported from Ireland in the summer of 1940. His reports were rather alarmist. They stressed levels of cooperation between Irish Republicans and the Germans. And these were seriously considered by Churchill in the War Cabinet as they pondered possibly a preemptive invasion of ERA to prevent the Germans from doing so. Irish neutrality was a great disappointment to him, as it was to Churchill and to many British officials. I think he could not imagine an era that was not a part of the British Empire, not responding, falling in line with the British during this time of World War. And I think like a lot of these former policemen, you know, he spends time in Ireland, but also, you know, he spends a lot of his time in England, too, which I think reveals these both sides of his identity.
That's wonderful. Thanks, Michael. A real life daring do.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate your time. Thanks a million.
And that is the end of our first season. So thank you so much for listening. Thank you for joining us. The Empire spans so much of the globe and so many centuries. There are so many people we could have covered and would love to cover. So please, if you like the show, share it with your friends. The more shares, the more likely we are to convince somebody somewhere to let us do more of these and have
There's
more fun.
There's so many more lives that we could have covered in this 6 series.
If you know of any historical figures you'd like us to feature on future episodes, please reach us by email. We are irishimperiallives@rte.ie.
Huge thanks to all of those who've contributed to getting the show on air, to producer Jack Murphy, Elizabeth Larrigy, Sally Curran, Nigel Wheatley, and to composer Bill Whelan.
And if you've missed any of our previous episodes, including the heroic derring-do of founder of the American Navy, John Barry, or the incredible story of the Irish famine girls sent to Australia, you can hear them all anywhere you listen to podcasts if you just search Irish Imperial Lives.